For our final panel of the day, we are going to, I think, continue the discussion of some themes that came up in the previous panel on CRT in schools. And I'm going to briefly introduce our moderator, Allison Soman. Allison is a legal fellow at the Center for the Separation of Powers at the Pacific Legal Foundation. She joined there last summer after working for over a decade to Gail Heriot, another friend of the Federal Society, on the U.S. Commission for Civil Rights. She has deep roots in the Liberty Movement. She was a Koch associate, worked at the National Federation for Independent Business Legal Foundation, and during law school, clerked at IJ and the Koch Foundation. She holds a JD from Emory and an undergraduate degree from Dartmouth. She has been published extensively on the Federal Society's blog and our journal, so take a look for those articles. And we're excited to have her. This is, I think, one of the few times, the first time she's been moderating, so we're very excited to have her speak. Allison, I'll turn things over to you.
All right. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Great. Okay, good afternoon and welcome to today's third panel, the topic of which is critical race theory in schools. Just to set up today's discussion in what seems to be an effort to rectify the pernicious effects of past and perhaps present racism we've seen in recent years, K-12 schools giving increased attention to racial issues. There's little serious dispute that students should learn about slavery, the civil rights movement, and other important parts of our country's history. But there's much more controversy about school diversity trainings that, at least according to some of their critics, unfairly stereotype or scapegoat people based on their race. Some have called these types of trainings critical race theory trainings, although the link between them and critical race theory as it is practiced in the academy is disputed, and I gather will be discussed by some of today's panelists. As an example of how this has taken off in the public imagination, the Biden administration has proposed, but later walked back, a federal rule that would have prioritized funding for school districts doing certain types of trainings in this vein, which was ultimately not adopted. Lawmakers in 16 different states have introduced or passed legislation this year seeking to limit the teaching of critical race theory within public institutions. Parents across the country have been pushing back against school boards and have filed some cases now in litigation. Among the questions that today's panel will explore, what is critical race theory? Should the education department prioritize its teaching and funding? Are states and localities within their rights in designing and limiting curricula and about what can and cannot be taught in public schools, or do laws that do so potentially violate the First Amendment? We have three panelists today to speak to these questions. The first is Dr. Christopher Brooks, professor of history at East Stroudsburg University, where he teaches several courses, including one on the history of political correctness and several on legal history. In addition to his work at ESU, he is also a founding member and vice president of the Harrisburg Lawyers Chapter of our own Federalist Society. The second panelist today will be Joe Cohn, who is the legislative and policy director at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Before coming to FIRE, he had an extensive resume advocating for freedom of speech and other civil liberties at other organizations. Finally, last but not least, we'll hear from Taylor Meehan, who is counsel at Consovoy McCarthy, where she represents clients in all phases of litigation with a focus on constitutional litigation and appellate matters. And with that, Professor Brooks, please go ahead and begin your remarks.
Good afternoon. Fewer and fewer Americans actually take issue with a complete telling of American history. And I'm tasked today with just kind of laying out how CRT evolved, and then in subsequent discussion, we can get into the weeds as to application and all of that. So first, what is it? It is not an umbrella ideology of all things having to do with diversity and inclusion, for starters. Critical race theory examines the matter of race, racism, and power with an aim to transforming those relationships. Unlike the incrementalism of the American Civil Rights Movement, that I'm sure we're all a little bit more versed in, CRT theorists question the classical liberal order as a whole. thus the charges of illiberalism that you've probably read in the press. So, as a whole, from the Enlightenment to principles of neutrality and equality purported in constitutional law. In short, CRT proponents would generally hold that our nation's legal system is systemically racist. And I'm going to quote from Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the CRT's founders, in that just because I think this really hits the nail on the head in an article of hers. Actually, even better, I'll do one better. Actually, even better quote from Richard Delgado, who is the author of the Introduction to Critical Race Theory. From an article of his, quote, "Most racism is not a deviation. As a number of critical writers have been pointing out, racial subordination is an ordinary, quote, normal, end quote, feature of our social landscape. It is, quote unquote, normal science. The ordinary state of affairs, because racism is an ingrained feature of our cultural landscape, it looks ordinary and natural to everyone in that culture. It is, quote unquote, the way things are," in the words of Richard Delgado. So, again, how do we get there? So, really, if you're going to look at a timeline, you start really with the critical theorists, moving on to the critical legal theorists, to critical race theory. That's pretty much your chronology. So, who are the critical theorists? Critical theory first appears in Germany around 1930 at the Institute for Social Research, aka the Frankfurt School. Little anecdotal here, I did my doctoral work in Germany. I was a research assistant, or actually an associate, research associate, at the Institute for Research on North America. And we were diagonally across the street from the Frankfurt School. I attended numerous colloquy with the researchers there. We could start name dropping, I'll save that, but you get the point. I've been familiar with this school of thought for the past 20 years. Critical theorists aim to emancipate humanity from slavery, virtual or literal, endeavoring to create a world which satisfies the needs of and powers of human beings by ideologically liberating them. In the words of one proponent, from systematic racist and capitalist ways. Now, most of the focus is on capitalism because really the critical theorists, the neo-Marxists, they're transferring the ideas of Marxism with that ultra-focus on economics and moving it almost exclusively into the social sphere. To connect the crits, as they were known, the critical theorists, in the United States, it's pretty easy. During World War II, they moved to the United States and were housed at Columbia University. And one of the, I'll just say, intermediaries was a sociologist named Lewis Wirth, who was a German-born American who was also associated with the Frankfurt School through his work there. And in early critical, and he was also very closely tied with early critical theorist Max Horkheimer, considered really the father of the Frankfurt School. So Wirth once wrote, "A minority as a group was singled out by the others in the society in which they live for differential and unequal treatment due to physical or cultural characteristics." And he continued, "These minority groups regard themselves as objects of collective discrimination." Now notice the collective, and if you know anything about Marxism, yeah, collective. Wirth also claims that there was a societal minority where there's a societal minority, there's also a, quote, corresponding dominant group enjoying higher social status and greater privileges. This is largely based off of the writings of Gramsci, who was mentioned earlier in this program, who talks about hegemony. And maybe we can get into that later on. Then there is the critical theorist rejection of scientism, and this is an interesting bit too. And scientism is a belief that the usual inductive methods of natural sciences are the only way to yield true knowledge about man and society. Like the critical theorist comrades, Wirth argued, although sociologists, quote, are of course as scientists, or would be scientists, almost everything we do is tied up with the problem of values. The problem of values. Think about that. In other words, applying scientific method to the study of human behavior, organization, and the laws policing human societies did not always work so well. This anti-scientific thinking set the stage for, or you could even say illiberal thinking, set the stage for modern day parlance, for an example being when someone is asked to speak his or her truth, as if a dialectical exchange can't lead to a truth that is acceptable through mutual discussion. For in this world, there cannot be any absolute or constant truth, or even a discoverable one. We are painfully ensconced in a relativist viper pit, though. It leads many to wonder what is right and what is wrong. The Crit's manner of questioning our views of the world segued nicely during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s into new left approaches, the sort of this studies, that studies, this studies, so I won't get into all that. They were neo-Marxist and, in a good number of cases, radical. They not only questioned the authoritarian nature of the Soviet Union, which, you know, during the Cold War one would expect, influenced by the writings of Wirth and social scientists like C. Wright Mills, held that conflict theorist histories emerged from the intellectual tussling of critical theorists. With its start in the late 1970s, critical legal theory took this, the crits, the critical theorists, to a new realm, the law. Critical legal theorists theorized that the crits, or critical theorists, represented, in the words of Harvard Law CLT advocate Roberto Unger, quote, an instance of illusion passing into prejudice, an instance of illusion passing into prejudice. So CLT, critical legal theorists, aim to free the legal system from prevailing unjust hierarchies that were considered normal. The endeavor to delegitimize a legal system they saw as perpetuating an oppressive social order. So basically, these scholars looked at the law as inherently subjective, or certainly from a subjective perspective, and this came through the lens used to view history. This lens, as it were, finds its immediate origins in the writings of German philosopher Hans Georg Gadamer. He is best known for studies in hermeneutics, a study of how we interpret things. As well explained by Brad Sherman, Gadamer believed that one needed to confront the words of the text before you. Confront the words of the text before you and be open and willing to, quote, expose, challenge, and criticize prejudices highlighted by the text. At this point, and this point is reached with willingness to listen and also admit error. So on the surface, this sounds wonderful, but the reality is this is leading to setting the stage for deconstructionism, basically taking meaning and reading into that meaning, assuming meaning. But again, we can get into that in greater detail later because I'm limited on time and I want to get to critical race theory, which is the next step. So piggybacking off of CLT, Some non-Caucasian legal scholars did not feel the CLT folks were able to see their issues with the law as clearly as they thought they did, perhaps because hubris preventing them from processing, quote, a willingness to listen and also admit error. Critical race theory, therefore, became a neo-Marxist theoretical framework questioning power relations associated with racially driven oppression as manifested in the legal system. CRT is the tinted glasses of Gadamer and other neo-Marxists like Gramsci and Marcuse through which to view behaviors, most noted those written into policy. The idea took a stronghold in the ivory towers of American law schools after a 1989 CRT workshop in Madison, Wisconsin, that was organized by CRT's primary founders, Derrick Bell, Alan Freeman, Kimberly Crenshaw, and, of course, Richard Delgado. Insofar as this applies to this whole thing, this whole discussion applies to this panel, one about CRT in our K-12 schools, CRT, as such, is, I seriously doubt, taught in schools. However, there's a few things. First, we may get into this too in discussion, CRT becomes the foundry or foundation of a lot of the thinking that goes into a lot of the diversity and inclusion training that is so common. And as mentioned in the outset here by Allison, that it is not, CRT again, is not something that, well, actually, this is not exactly what you said. CRT is not something that, honestly, most school teachers even be equipped to teach. They wouldn't. It is taught in law schools. It is taught in graduate programs. But that doesn't negate the fact that this thinking, this binary, this neo-Marxist binary of oppressor versus oppressed isn't so incredibly pervasive in the teaching of teachers, in the teaching in schools, and other places in our society. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for having me today. My name is Joe Cohn. I'm the Legislative and Policy Director at FIRE. FIRE does exclusively higher education civil liberties, so we're not really engaged on the K-12 side of this much, although some of the concepts bleed into each other, and we've done a little bit of commentary there. To tee up the discussion a bit further, I don't want to debate whether or not CRT is good or what counts as CRT and what doesn't count as CRT. And I don't want to debate, the extent of the harms, but we should be asking the question of whether society benefits or is harmed when ideas and arguments are banned from classrooms by legislative bodies. So what are the normative implications of bans and the legal implications of those bans? So those are the kind of things I want to think about a little bit. I want to clear the deck with some higher ed aspects of this debate first, so that when we get into more of the discussion on K through 12, that part will be a bit out of the way. But the Supreme Court of the United States has found repeatedly that the First Amendment protects academic freedom and higher education from government intrusion. So you have Sweezy versus New Hampshire in 1957, where they say, teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, society will stagnate and die. I mean, that's pretty strong words. And then, you know, a decade later, in Keishian versus the Board of Regents, the court says that a special concern, that academic freedom is a special concern of the First Amendment, which doesn't tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom. And then, of course, Healy versus James, the big Supreme Court case dealing with free speech in the classroom. They say state colleges and universities are not enclaves immune to the sweep of the First Amendment, and declare that the protection for free speech is nowhere more vital than the community of American schools. And then, you know, lastly, I'm going to round this out, you know, with Papish versus Board of Curators of the University of Missouri, where the court says the mere dissemination of ideas, no matter how offensive to good taste, on a state university campus may not be shut down in the name alone of the conventions of decency. And I start the comments there because I want us to think about very bright line distinctions between higher ed, where there's an academic freedom concern, where professors aren't there to just impart knowledge, but also there to explore difficult questions from a variety of different angles and try to theorize about, you know, different ways of thinking in the world. It's not just about, you know, transmitting what we know, it's sometimes about finding and seeking out new knowledge. So there are crucial importance of academic freedom in higher education. Those same considerations are not necessarily present in K-12, where you're usually talking about government speech of the government's curriculum to a captive audience of minors. So you don't have the same academic free speech concerns with respect to teachers, but you'd still have other constitutional concerns that should at least still be on everyone's mind. One of them is you always want to think through questions of vagueness, right? Is it fair to punish someone for something that's unclear? Like, what's the line that's drawn for a teacher that makes it clear or unclear that they can't cross before there's going to be, you know, a penalty? And I also want you to think through some of the other doctrines at play here. The doctrines that I think about on the higher ed side in particular are overbreath. You know, are you targeting what you think you're targeting? Are you targeting more than you think you're targeting? Prior restraints, what it means under the law to ban things up front versus being responsive when speech crosses the lines. There are, of course, tremendous societal distinctions about how you handle speech that's unprotected that still don't sometimes allow for prior restraints. And then, of course, the concept of viewpoint discrimination comes into play, at least on the higher ed side, right? We're taking one particular point of view on a topic off of the table. Well, that would be, you know, clear viewpoint discrimination. So on the K-12 side, I want you to be thinking about the potentialness of vagueness, but also I want you to be thinking about the question of prior restraints. I'm not telling you your answer should be one way or another way. Okay, on this question, but you should be actively thinking about, do we want to be taking things off of the table up front, or do we want to be thinking about other ways to respond to arguments that might cross other lines, like here you have the intersection of speech versus anti-discrimination rationales, where the argument is that some of these arguments that are at least put under the umbrella of CRT, at least in this debate, may themselves be discriminatory, singling out some people as oppressors and other people as victims, going to actual segregation, et cetera. So that's kind of what I wanted to tee off the conversation with, and I hope we dive into a lot of these aspects deeper in the conversation when it unfolds, and hopefully we'll have some time to talk about some of the legislation as well. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Taylor.
Good afternoon. My name's Taylor Meehan, and as Allison mentioned, I'm a litigator. So I come at these issues, you know, boots on the ground, in a courtroom, filing complaints, defending against complaints. To give you a sense of some of our experience at Constable McCarthy, we are involved, for example, as defense counsel representing a group called Parents Defending Education. in the New York City litigation, where a group of plaintiffs have brought a lawsuit saying New York City's gifted programs in New York City's specialized schools are themselves unconstitutional under state law because they discriminate on the basis of race. And we are involved in large part because the relief that the plaintiffs seek in those cases and the relief that we're seeing in other cases pop up that are similar to that is self-described as race-conscious relief. And stepping in a litigation capacity, you know, going back to these first principles of constitutional law, that you can't necessarily have, you know, race-conscious relief in a K through 12 school to the extent your goal is to remove students of certain races from these programs. We are also constantly evaluating possible suits against, you know, school districts or against public actors. And in those suits, this is what makes this conversation interesting. It's not a lawsuit about CRT. It's a lawsuit about the manifestations of CRT in the K through 12 schools. And in my experience doing this, I can tell you that litigation is one of the tools in the toolbox. It is something that is often proposed as an alternative to something like a CRT ban that you see in Tennessee and other states. But it's not the only tool. So first, just quickly, I'll address what can be done with litigation, what we're seeing by different groups across the country, but also what are some of those other legislative tools, other policymaking tools that are in fact much more multidimensional than just a CRT ban. So the value of litigation, and it seems perhaps simple, is to put the Constitution and federal law and oftentimes state law back in the conversation. Schools and school administrators, some of whom are extremely well-intentioned, have forgotten that it's illegal, for example, to segregate students on the basis of race. A very common DEI initiative is to have these race-based groups where students can talk about issues just with students of the same race, and no one is in the middle of that proposal saying, well, wait a minute, we're public officials, I'm a state actor, am I allowed under the United States Constitution or under Title VI to segregate my students on the basis of race, to exclude a student from one of these groups because of their immutable characteristics. And so while litigation against one school, you know, there's some public interest groups, for example, public interest law firms in Minnesota who have filed lawsuits related to this where it's only about one school in Minnesota, but those lawsuits then gain some national attention, and all of a sudden the conversation in schools not only in Minnesota but also elsewhere is changing, where hopefully someone just raises their hand and says, there are certain legal obligations here that are fundamentally at odds with the CRT foundry. And we can't tell a fifth grader, you aren't invited because of your race. So it seems simplistic, but I do think schools are savable in that way, where if we can just kind of go back to first principles with respect to the Equal Protection Clause and also the First Amendment, we see viewpoint discrimination with the parents I talk to every day and their students in a way that's just as alarming as what you see in higher ed, you know, where a student will be told, well, you can't do this, even though all the other students are doing that. Your ideas are too controversial. There's a suit in Minnesota right now. You can have a Black Lives Matter flag, but you can't have a thin blue line flag. Things like that. So these are the primary substantive areas of law that frankly leapfrog or orthogonal to what really is CRT, but they very much involve manifestations of CRT. And the main substantive categories of those are equal protection claims, like what I mentioned before. Along with that, if you receive federal funding, you have certain obligations under the Civil Rights Act and Title VI in particular, so as not to discriminate on the basis of race and not to create a hostile educational environment. There are First Amendment claims as well, not only viewpoint discrimination, but compelled speech claims, like what can you make a student say in a classroom? And then something I never thought I'd be saying many, many years ago is we're also seeing, and we've seen this in some of the COVID litigation as well, schools and COVID-related litigation, a rebirth of these early substantive due process clause cases, Meyer and Pierce, where, you know, the basic holding is a parent has a right to control the educational outcomes of their child. And you're seeing those cases pop up, the Meyer and Pierce pop up more and more in some of these school-related cases where the school is no longer acting on behalf of or with the consent of the parent, but often at odds with the parent. So that's what litigation can do. But what litigation can't do is make school policy, right? And that's where you see two other important tools stepping in that I can't use in the courtroom. And those are state-level policies that are often oversimplified as just a straight-up CRT ban. You can't go into a classroom and tell one student they're an oppressor and one student they're a victim. You can't do that, CRT ban. But there's also other litigation tools, especially as I'm litigating these cases, that could be extremely useful at the state level, all of which have to do with transparency. So the state of play right now in many, many states is if you are a parent and you want to figure out what your student is learning, you can try to ask the school. Sometimes the school won't tell you. And so then you find yourself in the strange position as a parent of filing a Freedom of Information request, paying a fee of whatever the school tells you you have to pay, to then maybe figure out what your student is learning. It's an extraordinary situation when you compare it to, say, in Texas, they have a law where within three clicks you have to be able to identify a college syllabus for any Texas school. We could radically change the conversation, including what exactly are students learning. Like, part of the reason why there's this big fight about whether it's CRT or not CRT is we don't know. It's hard to figure out what is exactly going on in classrooms, especially elementary schools and middle schools. And one way to sharpen that debate and to really get parents involved and to really make sure that we all have the same set of facts is to increase transparency for these K-12 schools. Almost every school district has a website. Why isn't the reading list and the syllabus or whatever else on the website for each particular school? Other legislation is transparency with consultants. So a lot of these schools will bring in a diversity consultant. I'm not here to say one way or another whether that's good or bad, but I do think transparency would be very helpful to know what the consultant is teaching, to have the consultant or the group more broadly come to the school board, introduce themselves, and have just a little bit of accountability. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, to know what they're being paid. That could be, again, tremendously helpful and allow parents to have some amount of involvement in what's being taught to their kids, both within the school and also these diversity consultants and others. And it could also create a better marketplace for diversity consultants so that it's not the same groups going throughout the country. And then finally, there's legislation that's short of a CRT ban, but you can imagine legislation that just reinforces pre-existing anti-discrimination law. And legislation that, similar to litigation, is just reminding teachers, hey, you can't segregate students on the basis of race in a K-12 school, and other manifestations of that as well. So with that, I don't want to talk much more. I'm happy to turn it over to broader discussion.
Thank you all. Do you want each one to take a moment to respond to some of the things that the others have said? We'll begin again with Professor Brooks.
Yeah, I think that the idea of equal protection under the law is something that kind of gets lost in the shuffle. There's an old saying that a lot of you may be familiar with, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think that a lot of the diversity and inclusion initiatives, some many with the Kendian, if I can use that term, of the writings of Ibram Kendi, who actually did his PhD down the road there in Temple, I believe. What did he argue that CRT was, quote, fundamental to his ideology? I think that that gets lost in the shuffle in the intent of correcting past wrong. But I think that, too, leads us to the discussion of equality versus equity, right? So equal opportunity versus, you know, basic, with equity, we're almost looking for equal outcomes. And this over-focus on outcomes as opposed to opportunity and people developing the individual, be that a K through 12 student or even a university student, developing intellectually and otherwise. So that's all I wanted to quickly say.
Joe?
Well, there's a lot I have actually to say on this on this topic, and there's a lot that the comments from my co-panelists have said that's brought some ideas to my mind. Let me start with the notion of equality and equity, and this intersection of anti-discrimination law. Make an observation or two. The first is that I think that it's important in a lot of contexts to prioritize equality under the law over equal outcomes. But I also think that there's a legitimate part of the political debate about when you're talking about distribution of resources and those kind of questions that aren't just about equal legal outcomes, asking a question to society and legislatures, what is equitable? Like, what would be the right way to do a tax system? How should we be funding schools, to make sure that we get better outcomes? That part of the conversation about equity, is one that's going to be with us regardless of however any one of us feels. That's the fundamental debate each and every year in every legislature, every time you debate a budget bill or an appropriation. So I think that the real distinction here is when you get into the classroom and you have teachers trying to teach about, how to get a more egalitarian society, and they shift into that equity model where you're not really talking about the resources, but talking about what rights and should people have, and how should they, and how should we look through this lens of equality? And I think that Professor Brooks is right that there are enough examples of teachers that take the equity of view to an extreme. So that's kind of observation number one. The second observation that I really want to emphasize is the juxtaposition that this debate has created in the political world on the sides of the political spectrum. At FIRE, I have now dealt with a decade of mostly dealing with ways that activists and legislators on the left want to prioritize equal protection over free speech, on college campuses. That the bar is high between when speech loses its protection and becomes actually discriminatory is something that they are extremely concerned about, and there are a lot of legislative and legal efforts to change that. In this conversation, the roles are almost identically reversed, where you have the right talking about the anti-discrimination rationales that justify all kinds of different limitations on what can be said, both in higher ed classrooms and K through 12. And I want to emphasize this point, which is there are bills, there are so many bills that they're pretty diverse, but there are several that have flat out bans on what can be said in college classrooms. Ohio, Wisconsin, here in Pennsylvania, for example, the legislation explicitly bans ideas from being in the classroom. You have bills in Texas, Florida, Tennessee, Arkansas that have passed on the K through 12 side, where again you don't have the free speech concerns, but you're still talking about prioritizing taking ideas off of the table for an anti-discrimination rationale, just with the players just being reversed. So I think it's an interesting thing to think about how people stay and want to stay principled in this discussion in a way that makes sense, where we draw the distinctions in K through 12 and higher ed that we need to draw. And I think those are my preliminary observations. I'd like to turn it over to Taylor.
Yeah, as Joe can predict, I have a lot of thoughts on his last point, which in my overarching thought is it's just much, much more complicated than that. I think the free speech issues facing K through 12th graders are themselves the free speech issues are actually motivating some of what we see in the CRT bans and then everything that comes within that. They actually hold together quite well. I mean, imagine being a conservative seventh grader in a middle school nowadays, and you're constantly being taught not how to think, but what to think, and your views are just completely at odds with most of the views espoused in your classroom or by your classmates. And so I don't know that I'm ready to concede that I'm prioritizing anti-discrimination laws over, you know, free speech, because in some ways, some of what the aim of these anti-discrimination laws, which are extremely tricky and would be something interesting to talk about, is how you actually legislate this sort of thing. But some of the aim actually is to revive speech and free speech, and not just a teacher's speech, but also student speech within the limitations of Tinker and everything else within the schools. I mean, you have CRT or the CRT foundry in a way implicates core speech of political speech and religious speech by students. And when you have, again, teachers, the curriculum, not necessarily teachers themselves, but when curriculum is all about how to think, that speech gets taken away from the student. And for a student to raise their hand in that classroom takes a tremendous act of courage that even is hard for someone like me to relate to, given when I went to school. So I don't know that the roles are reversed. I would just say in K through 12 school, it's much more complicated. The other thing that's much more complicated in a K through 12 school, and I think we will start seeing this from the other side in a state like Tennessee or elsewhere, is what is a K through 12 teacher's free speech rights as compared to that college professor? I would doubt that a court would hold that they are the same in light of precedents like Garcetti and others.
Yeah, they definitely aren't.
Yeah.
If I could jump in just for a quick moment, just to be really clear on this, I don't want to be conflating and making the argument, because I am not making the argument at all, that in K through 12, rules that would make decide what the curriculum are present that same juxtaposition that puts folks on the right trying to prioritize the equal protection over free speech stuff. But I am dealing with legislators and bills and language that unequivocally do that. And they are 100%, not 99%, 100%, every sponsor of every one of those bills is a Republican. So there is no doubt in my mind that there are pockets of the conservative movement who are not making this higher ed versus K-12 distinction, who are making the prioritization exactly as I'm describing. And when they discuss it, I guess because bumper stickers and slogans are better than the kind of deep analysis we're doing today for public advocacy, say that there's no space in the classroom for these ideas. And they're not saying in their speeches making a distinction between K through 12, you know, or higher ed. So again, you know, I actually agree with the complete analysis that Taylor was describing in terms of the K through 12 distinction and it being far more complex there. But we do need to still grapple with the instinct that is existing on a very political part of the pocket to just make the reverse argument.
Can I?
Go ahead.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay. To piggyback off of that, I think that as we have this discussion, it seems to be on an either or, Republican versus Democrat, left versus right, whatever. And that's part of the entire polemic here. It really doesn't need to be. I think that, you know, we've, as a nation, collectively, many of us have lost sight of trying to find common ground. Something I've been working on, and hopefully it'll end up getting published in the next few weeks, I'm looking at some non-Marxist ways to promote inclusion in the teaching of social studies. I think we all, as a society, need to start talking about solutions and not how much we disagree with the other side, quote unquote. It's destructive, and counterproductive.
Did either of you wish to respond?
No, I mean, I just agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I was unaware of before litigating some of these cases is that, like, there's a real market for that, right? Like, and I think part of the problem is parents aren't totally aware of what's going on, and, like, most parents don't know that a school might have a diversity consultant or someone else. Like, if you're in curriculum or if you want to be a diversity consultant, any of that, like, there's a real, I think parents are really waking up and they want their kids to have a well-rounded education, like the good, the bad, the ugly about the country's history in a way that doesn't make their kids themselves feel like they're the perpetrator of that. Like they want that well-rounded education. It requires more than, I'm rambling, but basically there's a real market, I think, for what you've mentioned. And I do think that increased transparency, like if parents just knew what was happening now and so they could propose solutions going forward, that would be very helpful.
Joe, you've weighed in on legislation before. I was curious what you think about transparency bills, whether they're less problematic than some of the other bills you've discussed a little while ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Way less problematic. The one thing that I think about still went up with the transparency bills, there have been a few that have been drafted in such a way that didn't just require, like, just disclose what it is that you're going to teach, but they'll say something like, a few of them have been drafted to say that you cannot teach anything or use any material until you have brought it to the school board first in a public meeting for debate and discussion and approval. Now, for practical purposes, that just doesn't cut it. I mean, you can't have a teacher who's unable to talk about a news article or something that happened yesterday, you know, et cetera. Now, that's different than the general concept that I think Taylor's describing of, you know, the curriculums and what's planned in advance should be disclosed. So that parents can have that kind of input, which I think is undoubtedly positive.
Are there audience questions? Could you approach the microphone, please?
Yes. Is there anyone who has taken on the project of preparing model school transparency legislation? And if there's not, how can we help jumpstart that, or how can we help contribute to it?
So I guess I'll start first, since I do the legislative stuff. You know, FIRE only does higher ed things, so I haven't done a model K-12 transparency bill, but I have done red lines for, you know, edits for some legislators that wanted to look into what they could put in bills that would require, you know, professors to publish syllabi, for example, and so that I have done. I don't know anyone who's dealing with this in the K-12 space who isn't from a bigger organization that has, say, 15 or 20 different issues that they're following or as part of their portfolio, the way, like, FIRE is dedicated, you know, exclusively to this one issue, so I'm not plugged into it. But I guarantee you that their organizations, you know, Heritage, you know, others that are watching this and weighing in and at ALEC, et cetera, that are thinking about that issue.
Go ahead.
So I guess this question may be best directed to Joe, but in terms of whether there are restrictions from a policy level, not a legal level, that you would support or find acceptable in terms of what teachers can teach in a K-12 classroom. So I assume that, like, we'd all be okay and would want teachers to not say someone is inherently superior based on the color of their skin.
Yep.
But if we were to tell a fifth grade teacher that she can't say someone's inherently an oppressor based on the color of their skin, would that be something that's good, neutral?
No, that's a great question. No, I appreciate it. So I'm not speaking for FIRE when I say this, because we don't have K-12 positions. So I'll speak for myself to answer that. I don't oppose any of that thinking. So a lot of these bills have the list of what they refer to as either divisive concepts, that's the word that was used in President Trump's executive order that was first used about this issue, and then a lot of legislatures picked up that terminology. Some call them racist or sexist ideas, and they have a list. Someone is morally inferior because of, you know, an immutable characteristic like their skin color is on the list, that, you know, that America is inherently racist is on the list, all of these other, you know, things that are, I found them pretty anodyne. Like, most of the items on that list would be violations of Title VI if they were, you know, from a teacher to student where there's that kind of power dynamic in K-12 anyway. What I would caution legislators, if there are any in the room here that are, you know, that are thinking about the issue, is that you don't want to label things inherently by the legislature as racist or sexist, et cetera, even if you can legally take them off of the table with the exact same list. We don't historically label things racist or sexist in state legislatures, because what will happen here in Pennsylvania or what will happen in California or in Arkansas or Alabama is going to wildly differ. And we don't want to politicize those concepts. Instead, we rely on courts to figure out what is and is not, you know, racist. Now, that problem isn't there with respect to saying this isn't going to be taught as part of our curriculum, but you still don't want to set that, you know, open that Pandora's box of saying it's acceptable for the government to decide that certain arguments themselves are inherently, you know, racist, sexist, et cetera. So that's still a consideration.
Yes.
A very practical application on the ground example of what you guys have been talking about. I live in Abington Township, nice, solid, suburban school district. A candidate for school board asked the existing school board members whether there was any teaching of critical race theory. The answer was unanimous, no. Taylor's quite right. Right to know requests are a wonderful thing. In fact, one of their classes, the teacher, I believe, took essentially a how to write a paper class and made it clear that the topics of the paper you were writing on could only address how the systemic racism in America impacted, take your pick, music, education, whatever. There was no ability to question the premise that the United States is inherently systemically racist. I agree. I'm not sure that's critical race theory. But it kind of slipped through because of the ambiguities of language. I should also point out, my wife is a high school teacher in a different school district to remain unnamed. She regularly has conservative students who are scared to death of either admitting to the fact they're conservative, admitting to the fact that they're Christian, admitting to the fact they're religious. It is a pervasive problem. Thank you.
Did anyone want to respond?
I don't know if this is responsive or just more similar thoughts, which is CRT. I think labeling some of what is going on in K-12 schools as CRT was something to do to try to group all of these ideas together. And I do agree. That's why most litigation isn't putting CRT on trial, because it's just too hard to pin down when you're talking about a fifth grade classroom or even a 12th grade classroom. One thing that gets lost too, as we start to debate, is it CRT or is it not CRT, is this idea that, you know, the ideas that you mentioned, you don't want to tell a fifth grader or even set up the oppressor victim dichotomy for them. But in a high school classroom, you almost hope that everyone's got the foundation from elementary school and middle school, right? Where high school classrooms, you probably want some, you actually want people asking questions about it and be able to talk openly about it. And I hear from parents every day, largely high school students, who cannot tell anyone they're a Christian. And that tells me we've had like kind of a fundamental breakdown right there. If I get to high school and I'm a 12th grader and I feel like I can't say out loud these sort of like things that are at the core of my identity, let alone have an adult attempt to have an adult discussion about it, like we've really lost the plot in terms of public education and frankly even private education in large parts of the country.
Yes.
So this question is directed to Professor Brooks. You mentioned how critical race theory has this underpinnings in the Marxist ideology of class struggle. And I was wondering how that is applied in a K-12 environment and how your proposal to teach some of the history of our country without implicating this sort of issue of this sort of ideology of class struggle would be done.
All right. I obviously can't speak for every school district in this state, let alone the whole country. The school district in which my children are, quite frankly, I think they're doing fairly well and trying to bridge divides to the best of their ability based on what I've seen so far. But as far as, you know, I guess you're kind of asking what kind of solutions, right? Something I touched on in an article I wrote for Real Clear, and I'm working on another one for them now, is it touches on the African diaspora and the teaching of the African diaspora and weaving it into the teaching of American history. And when we talk about the diaspora, I'll keep this as brief as possible, you're talking about groups that dispersed to other parts of the world. The terms first applied to Jewish diaspora and then later on to other groups of people. And I think that this is how that works. It's basically a group of people come from place A, and for whatever reason, for good, bad, or ugly reasons, are moved or moved to place B. What cultural norms and practices do they bring to that new place? And I think that is an honest approach that allows people to draw their own conclusions based on the facts, as opposed to me saying, you know, to somebody who is, you know, of French American origin, you're an oppressor. One could say I'm anti-Marxist, and recognize that there is a problem with respect to race in this country. There has been for hundreds of years, but to argue that it is the only problem, the most important problem, I don't know. But that's just my personal opinion. But I guess to boil it down to its true essence, it's a question of how, not if. You know, how do we address the problem, not if we address the problem. The problem's there. And if we watch the pundits, there is a problem, and it's everything. There isn't a problem. You're imagining it. There is one. It's real. I mean, all you have to do is listen to somebody like, pull out of the hat. Well, multitude of people, Senator Tim Scott, who was pretty candid when he was talking about the crime bill, about, you know, having been basically cited for impersonating a congressman while wearing his pin. So, is racism real? Absolutely it is. But is the cure-all, lining up kids back-to-back and saying, take one step forward if you fill in the blank? I'm not convinced that that's a sound solution. I think that teaching and this is really what I'm proposing is really looking at things through a very different lens. I would call it true inclusion or a roadmap to true inclusion, but it's going to take a lot of legwork, a lot of reading, and a very different approach to history, the writing of history, because, as you know, the majority of people who go on to teach social studies in, say, junior high, high school, they major, I'd say over 90% of them, major in history. So we historians have a little work to do if the desire's even there, which is a whole nother question.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. I couldn't help but think about a passage from Brandeis's concurrence in Whitney, not only during this panel, but also Professor George's panel. You know, the solution is more speech, not its suppression. So on that point, I would like to ask Professor Brooks, you mentioned that there is a lot of disagreement over, you know, something that Ms. Meehan had mentioned also, this idea that, you know, we're arguing about whether something qualifies as CRT or not. There's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of holes there. So in light of a lot of the banning legislation that Mr. Cohn had brought up, have you seen anything that would require almost a countervailing consideration in a classroom where something that is CRT inspired is being taught? So something that would compel more speech, basically, is what I'm saying, as opposed to a ban on specific speech. And whether, and Ms. Meehan, this is like a follow-up, are there any compelled speech issues under the First Amendment with that solution?
Could I ask you to stay at the microphone for just 1 minute? Because I just want to clarify, to make sure I understood the question. So you're asking if me or other panelists have any knowledge of CRT-inspired programs. If you could repeat that.
Not CRT-inspired programs. Legislative attempts to require school teachers to address countervailing considerations, regardless of whether or not, you know, those CRT considerations are present in the room. So like a more speech kind of thing.
That's probably a question for me, because
I come through all this stuff all the time. Yeah. A North Carolina bill that was vetoed by the governor included provisions that, instead of the bans, required, you know, the certain aspects of race be taught, and it described it in just more positive terms. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really kind of what you're asking about is, what about just bills that describe what you want the curriculum to look like, and setting a curriculum that has really, you know, stuff that's more unifying in the way that it addresses this topic. And certainly that's a model that could be used. I think the Texas bill that was enacted on the K-12 side included some provisions listing specific things that they wanted included in the curriculum as well. I think where you deal with a compelled speech problem is not in a curriculum that you set, but really thinking this through the lens, and Taylor can expand on this further, about what a student's rights are in the classroom and can they be compelled to agree. Hmm. And the answer is that they can't be compelled to agree with a particular point of view. We've seen bills in two states that dealt specifically with that question. Actually, one state, Idaho. Hmm. Idaho prohibited compelling people to personally adhere, agree, you know, affirm you know, particular points of view. You know, I had a little bit of a beef with some of the grammar of the sentence it used, because I want to make sure that law schools, for example, can still require people to engage in devil's advocacy.
Right. Yeah.
You know, prevent people to advocate. But the sentiment of what it was trying to do is a better model.
Cool. Thank you.
I have very little to add other than I love your idea for high schoolers. I think that would be great. And the compelled speech issues, I agree, you see in assignments and things like that, or, you know, these sorts of privilege exercises, but not necessarily within the curriculum.
I just want to piggyback, or actually it's a question, if I can ask a follow-up.
Sure.
Based off of this. Do you think it'd even be plausible to build into legislation or for legislators to consider defining race and or racism? Because that seems to be a big problem. Because, I mean, quite frankly, if most people, let's say white people, for lack of a better expression, will define it by biological means, where the CRT folks, well, just to generalize, are looking at it more from a phenomenological, sociological perspective and power struggles. So I think that there's a real divide when the definitions, and anybody who studied law knows this too, if the definitions aren't consistent, how can you have any consistent policy?
So I'm going to try. I know we're getting close to the end of our time, so I'm going to try to be fast on this.
Go ahead.
One, it would not be constitutional to define what is and is not racism, sexist, et cetera, for the Pandora's box, which is described in the over-politicizing of that country. In the United States, we prohibit discrimination based on, you know, protected classes as opposed to racism itself or sexism, et cetera. That being said, with that particular, you know, caveat drawn out, this is one of the reasons why I'm so much more optimistic about the litigation than I am about most of the legislation in this sphere, because litigation has the benefit of being able to take a fact pattern that happened, evaluate it with existing law like Title VI, et cetera, and apply these kind of principles to set guideposts for people moving forward. Mm-hmm. Because anytime you start doing a legislative restriction, again, I'm fully conceding that you can legislate what the curriculum is going to look like without having the legal problem here. But anytime you try to, from above, from the legislature, decide what's off the table, you're almost always going to be broader than you think you are being. You're almost always, no matter how precise you try to be, your result is almost always going to be a little bit broader than you thought you were with the most of care. I see that all of the time, you know, in a lot of different contexts.
So just in short, because I know somebody else wants to get in a question, but so the only way to really do that would be to legislate, to achieve some sort of consensus on definition. That would be the job of the judiciary, not of the legislature. Yeah. Okay. So that's what I thought, but I wasn't clear. Thank you.
Go ahead.
For most of American history, men have trashed women's rights. They couldn't vote. They were disenfranchised in a variety of ways. They couldn't get into university. They couldn't become doctors. They couldn't become lawyers. All sorts of ways. We manifoldly, as men, discriminated against women. I guess the big question I have right now is our country unable to address this as an adult issue for adults to talk about and adults to deal with? Because we made a lot of progress with women after we really trashed them of all races. Didn't matter what their race was, they got trashed. So we made a lot of progress in that field. And I really am very concerned that little kids can't do too much about institutional problems. They're beyond their pay grade. They don't know what they're doing. We need adults with maturity and conviction, as Professor George talked about, to address the issues. Do something meaningful about it within the context of the best values of the American tradition. So I just, I feel like we're going to the wrong place for a solution to a big problem. This is an adult problem. Adults need to deal with it in the school district, and I hope that they can do so.
You know, I'm going to take this 10-second opportunity to plug my colleague's book, Undoctrinate, by my colleague Bonnie Kerrigan-Snyder. Came out a few weeks ago, and it's How Politicized Classrooms Harm Kids, Ruin Schools, and What We Can Do About It. And I guess, you know, I'm picking back off of that comment because it teed it up nicely, just because I think that, you know, Taylor alluded to it earlier, the younger the kids are, the less appropriate it is. I know that Professor Brooks talked about it a bit when he talked about kids being asked to step forward or step back. You've seen examples of that in like second grade and third grade classrooms, even first grade classrooms. The book catalogs a lot of these examples. But I also think we want kids not thinking about for the first time difficult issues when they arrive on college. So I think that as we get closer to the older kids are, the question is how at different ages do you start thinking about, you know, what's appropriate ways for them to at least be introduced to some of these topics? I'm probably with you that kindergarten is not an appropriate place, but I think that even by the time I was in eighth grade, starting to think through issues of fundamental fairness from a 10,000 foot, you know, perspective wasn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. And I worry about any of the prescriptions that are too restrictive and prevent us from having good discussions about what our problems are in society and how many of them are systemic versus individualized.
Okay. I think we have time for about one more question. Yes.
This is initially directed to the professor. Out of curiosity, I may be butchering the theory, so I wanted to get some clarification from you. We hear a lot about the word equity in the context of discussing things related to critical race theory, and before, one of the words was always equality. I wondered what the theoretical derivation of equity as it's applied in the CRT area might be, based on your research and your experience starting in Frankfurt and moving on to what you've done since then, and also who decides what is equitable as compared to equality, which is a somewhat more objective kind of measure?
I think the goal is really the biggest issue. So think about it this way. If, okay, I'm about 6'4", okay? And if I am with my youngest child, who's probably 4'9", 4 foot something in there, and we go to watch, we're watching a high school football game, okay? And there's a fence. Equality would give us both a box to stand on. Equity would give her a higher box to stand on. Me personally, I would just throw her on my shoulders. But that is really sort of, in layman's terms, what we're looking at. So that's the way it's prevented.
Is there a theoretical basis for that? Or is it, my concern is always when you hear that word, that you're having whoever the group in power is make a decision as to what they think.
And that was the second part of your question. Okay. Now, who makes the decision? And that goes to the argument of Gramsci. It's always the hegemony. Whoever's in control makes the decision. The victor writes history. All of these things. I don't think that's changed. And I think that human beings, as social, self-interested beings, how we change that. I mean, that's just humanity.
So let me give you a concrete legal kind of example to kind
sure.
of
hit
a little of this home. So you have this debate that's been going on for 20 years. Disparate sentencing, you know, over crack cocaine versus other forms of cocaine and other drugs, where, you know, there's a tremendous disparate impact. The law equally applies to anyone regardless of your skin color. So if you're looking at it from a straight equality perspective, there is nothing to see here. There's no problem at all. But if you're looking from an equity perspective, you have, you know, different populations doing different drugs, and it's the people who are people of color who are using the type of drugs disproportionately that have many, many, many longer, you know, sentences. So I think when you look at the critical legal theory perspective, the question is that equitable? Is that fair? And is that good? So I think the reason why I use that example is because there are plenty of other contexts we could come up with where using the equitable lens is really anything but, because it's about outcome-driven exclusively, you know, without taking in any of the other factors that may be causing the disparate outcomes that might be more justifiable. So the reason why I frame it in this light is because I urge all of us who are here, and we're all heavy thinkers. We're trying to engage seriously in these issues. So I want to dissuade anyone from saying you're always in right when you're talking about equality versus the equity side, or vice versa. I would be giving the same message to people on the other side, you know, of the political spectrum, who are saying we should always be looking at this through the equity lens because equality is insufficient. Well, no. Sometimes it's appropriate to look through one, and other times it's important to look at it through the other lens.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
I agree.
Does anyone have any concluding thoughts as we wrap up the panel?
We covered it.
All right. Thank you so much to you all. I really enjoyed this panel.